So now we're looking at the section of this text dealing with how to make our precious human life meaningful at the highest level. This is, in the Lamb Room, it's said to be someone of great scope or great capacity, that at this level we are not just concerned about achieving liberation from suffering ourselves, but we are now looking to help also liberate everyone else from suffering. And so, of course, the aspiration we need to develop here is this aspiration of bodhicitta. And so we had a verse there that talked about developing this aspiration of bodhicitta, which of course is the entry point into this Mahayana level of the practice. But then of course, on top of developing the aspiration, we have to engage in the practices to strive for enlightenment, which were the six perfections, which again can be condensed into the same three areas: ethics, concentration, wisdom. The second verse here was talking about the ethics part of the practice, that we need to engage, have that ethical foundation for our practice, and at this level, to help sustain that ethical lifestyle, we can take these bodhisattva vows, these 18 core vows and 46 secondary vows that can help sustain the ethical lifestyle in terms of the bodhicitta motivation, in terms of supporting our practice of the six perfections. And so now then the next verse is talking about the other two main core areas of practice of concentration and wisdom. So the verse at the bottom of the first page says, once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. So here we see those two practices of concentration and wisdom. The first line, once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects, is talking about the concentration practice or the shamatha practice. And the second line, and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, is talking about the vipassana practice. So let's have a look at these two practices. And first, I'd like to begin by talking about the shamatha practice, which here is mentioned in terms of having pacified distractions to wrong objects. So in this practice, and again here, as we see in the last line, it talks about the path of calm abiding and special insight. Is shamatha is a level of concentration that we develop in the spiritual path that's normally translated into English as calm abiding. And this is the minimum level of concentration we need to have a stable and enough and clear enough mind to be able to penetrate the nature of reality directly. So in this practice, generally in the text, it said there are two qualities we need to develop. We need to develop stability and clarity. So stability, of course, is a stable mind, meaning being able to focus on an object without becoming distracted. So, of course, the fault here is distraction. And that's the one that's explicitly mentioned here, having pacified distractions to wrong objects. So we need to overcome distraction to develop a stable mind, to be able to focus on a given object without becoming distracted. But then also, of course, not only do we need to be able to have a stable mind, we need to be able to focus on that object in a very clear way, And this is clarity. So what's stopping our mind being very clear, of course, is dullness. So that's the fault we need to overcome to develop clarity. So generally these are the two qualities that are talked about that we need to develop in the shamatha practice. But I like to add a third quality that's not so much mentioned in the texts, but I think is something very important for us again in the modern society. And that is the quality of relaxation. Because many of us come into meditation from very hectic, busy, stressful lives. And so our minds in our modern society tend to be very high strung, very agitated, very tense. And our minds tend to be very chaotic. And so normally in our daily life, if we have to focus on something at home or at work, we tend to really clamp down forcibly to focus, because otherwise we just fall over the place. And if we only have to focus for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we focus with that tension for a longer time, we become completely exhausted. And often we become very agitated. So this is not the approach that we want here in meditation. So what happens, of course, is people come into meditation often with this background, and then they're asked to focus, say, for example, on the breath, and their minds are so chaotic, they clamp down forcibly, really tightly focusing. And they manage to be able to focus a little bit on the breath, but then they get distracted. And then, of course, they get upset, and they clamp down even more because they think that they have to do that to hold that object. And so we get more and more tense. And then, of course, people start to complain that meditation gives them headaches. And they get completely exhausted from meditation. So, of course, the problem is not meditation. The problem is our technique. The problem is that we don't have this. That what is we're coming into the meditation with is too much tension. So I think for many of us, the first thing we need to do in meditation, particularly in shamatha practice, is we need to learn how to relax. Because if we don't have relaxation, a relaxed body and a relaxed mind, we're not going to be able to develop effectively these qualities. All that's going to happen is we're going to get exhausted from meditation, frustrated, maybe even get a lot of tension and headaches, and get really agitated. So we don't want to go there. So what we really need to do first is really relax in our meditation. Relax the body, relax the mind. When we then work on relaxing the body and the mind, then we can work on stabilizing our attention and then on clarity. And I can't overemphasize this enough, and I know from personal experience that if you have any tension in your meditation, you're going to have all sorts of problems. I would expect that for many of us beginners, most of the problems we experience in meditation is because of this. Most of the problems. Too tense. Too tight, too tense, trying too hard. It doesn't work. So we need to relax, 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 relax. So much so that I was doing, following a course in India recently, last few years, and there was a Tibetan Lama who was giving these instructions. You know, there was a big group, and in the group there was a lot of Asians, and Asians tend to be quite sleepy in meditation. I don't know why. But so he'd guide a meditation, and then we'd be meditating, and he'd be seeing a lot of the people sort of going like this, you know. And at the end of meditation, a couple of times he'd say he was very happy to see this, because he knew that that person wasn't like this. This is much worse than being sleepy. You know, at least being sleepy, we can sort of pep ourselves up a bit. But when we're here, it's going to have so much problems. So he said he was happy to see that. And he really meant that, because he knew these people definitely weren't here. So that's already a good start. So again, I can't overemphasize that this is just going to create so much problems in meditation. We really need to relax, and unfortunately our lifestyles automatically bring us there. Working many hours, deadlines, tension, stress, busy, stimulus, iPhones, media, noise. I mean, everything is just driving us in that direction. So we need to sort of let the body and mind relax, relax, relax. So really, this is very important. So these are the qualities that we're developing, and these are the faults that we're trying to overcome. Now, of course, in this practice, we are trying to focus on a particular object in meditation. And then the question is, well, what object should we use in this practice? And in the text, it mentions many different possibilities. And the bottom line is, use the object that works best for you. Having said that, the meditation texts often say, if you're the sort of person who has a highly discursive mind, always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. And I think that accounts for about 95% of us in our modern society. We're always thinking, 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 thinking. And the breath has a lot of benefits for that reason. Is the breath, of course, is physical. The sensations of the breath. So by focusing on that, it gets us out of our conceptual mind and into the body. So that's already a good start. And then most of our conceptual thinking is about the past and the future. Very rarely are we in the present moment. And of course, from a Buddhist perspective, living in the past and the future is a source for unhappiness. And some modern studies I've recently looked at are also coming to that very same conclusion, that living in the past and the future is a source for unhappiness. So the sensations of the breath, of course, only happen in the present moment. So by focusing on them, not only do we get out of our conceptual mind into the body, but we get out of the past and the future into the present moment. So for these reasons, I think the breath is probably going to be the best object for many of us in this practice. And also in the breath practice, we have three variations of that practice. There is what's called the full body breath practice, which is what we've been doing a little bit at the beginning of our meditations, where I say, simply focus on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, wherever you notice them most distinctly. So that is, you simply focus on the sensations associated with the breath in any part of the body you just happen to notice. Could be in the abdomen, here, nostrils, anywhere. And this is very good for developing relaxation, because the focus is very diffuse, and this also can be very well done in terms of overcoming tension using the corpse posture. Shavasana in yoga, lying flat on your back, arms a bit to the side, lying in your bed at home, and simply just noticing sensations in the body throughout the body as you breathe. And doing that is not only it's a shamatha practice, but it's really helping to release tension in the body and the mind. So this can be very good for if you notice yourself very tight and tense, particularly at the end of the day. This can be a very good meditation also as a transition to sleep. You know, often at the end of the day, we're all agitated and tense and we can't get to sleep. So then we just lie in our bed in that posture and just very gently notice sensations in the body, relaxing, relaxing, relaxing. And so this is a shamatha practice, and then also it's a good transition into sleep. So this is excellent for that purpose. Then we have a second variation of this practice is abdomen, which is focusing on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen, just noticing the rising and lowering of the abdomen as we breathe. And again, this is a fairly large area, not so difficult to focus on. Therefore, this is very good
for stabilizing the mind, because it's quite easy to focus on. So a number of Buddhist traditions really emphasize this practice. And then, of course, many traditions use the nostrils, the entrance of the nostrils here, the sensations of the breath in this area. Of course, this is a much smaller area of focus. Because it's a much smaller area of focus, it really helps us to improve the clarity of our focus. So we have these three variations of the breath practice, which are particularly suited for working with those three qualities. Another object that is often emphasized, particularly in the Mahayana traditions and within the Tibetan traditions, is focusing on the mind itself. Now, many people find that quite difficult because, of course, this is some physical tangible object. This is not some physical object. This is the mind itself. But there are also a lot of advantages with this object. Because again, particularly in our modern society, because in our modern society, we are really the slaves of our mind. That whenever some thoughts, emotions or memories come up in our mind, we tend to always follow them. We identify with them, we follow them, we get caught up in our stories, we're often overwhelmed by our thoughts, emotions and memories. And then often when something unpleasant comes up in our mind and we don't know how to deal with it, what we do, of course, is we try to suppress it, stuff it back down. Of course, that's not dealing with it. By suppressing these things, what often happens is it manifests as physical illness. I think a lot of our physical illnesses are simply due to suppressing negative mental events. And then we often project a lot of negativity onto the people around us because of that as well. So we really are the slaves of our mind. Whereas if we use the shamatha practice focusing on the mind, we'll become the masters of our mind instead of the slaves. Because in this practice, we simply develop the ability to be the observer or witness, observing our mind, observing thoughts arise and pass, arise and pass. Because every time something comes up and we identify with it and we follow it, we are strengthening that habit of it coming up, which means that the habit of that mental garbage coming up will get stronger and stronger. And of course, if something comes up and we try to suppress it, we're also feeding it. So therefore, what we need to do is simply observe. If we simply observe these things arise and pass, we're not feeding them, which means the habit of this mental activity coming up will get weaker and weaker. Our mind will naturally become more still. We don't need to fight with any of these. Because if we fight with these things and try to suppress them and push them away, that's like throwing petrol on the fire. It does not work. We do not need to fight with any of these things. All we need to do is step back and observe. Because not only if we observe, we're not feeding, which means our mind will naturally become more still. By simply observing, we cannot be overwhelmed. We can only be overwhelmed by our mental events if we do one of two things. Either we identify and follow, or we try to suppress. Both of those will guarantee that we get overwhelmed. If we simply be present and observe, arising and passing, no matter how strong it is, it can't harm us. These mental events, thoughts, emotions, memories can only harm us if we identify or suppress. If we just observe, they can't do anything to us. So we'll become the masters of our mind. So this practice is very good for this. So even though many people find that quite difficult, there are these very much huge advantages. So one thing that some people do and is okay is that if you find that too difficult to begin with, then begin here. Use the breath for some time, maybe some weeks, months or longer. And then once we start to get a little bit relaxed, a little bit stable, a little bit more clear, then we can switch to focusing on the mind. It'll probably work a lot better. There's one other option, that I think can be very much recommended in our modern society, and that is the shamatha with no object. which means simply resting in awareness itself. Often this is called awareness of awareness. And in our meditations, I've been adding a little bit of that at the end, where I've sort of said, you know, now release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. Simply rest in awareness itself. So that is this practice. And in this practice, we're simply resting in our awareness. Of course, appearances will arise, continue to arise, but in this practice, we don't focus on anything. In this practice, the second one, of course, we are observing these things arise, pass. In the third practice, they'll continue to arise, but we just ignore them. We don't try to push them away. We just rest in the awareness itself. This practice also, I think, can be very beneficial in our modern society, because in our modern society, we tend to identify with appearances all the time. Whereas in this practice, we're not doing that. We are simply resting in the mind, in the space where all these appearances arise. Which means then if we do this practice in daily life, we can have this very open, spacious mind amidst all these appearances without identifying and contracting around the appearances. And also this practice is really, we're getting in touch with the nature of our mind. And if we're very intuitive, this practice, even though it's a shamatha practice, can easily lead into realizing the nature of the mind, the vipassana practice. So this is also a very good bridge into the vipassana practice. And really we can easily gain insights into the nature of the mind through this practice. So these are three practices or three objects that I think are very much recommended in our modern society. Now, a number of you, of course, who've studied the Lam Rim, generally in the Lam Rim texts, the object that's often recommended is a mental image of a Buddha. But I think many of us find that extremely difficult. Because one, often we're not familiar with a Buddha, what a Buddha looks like. And secondly, many of us have difficulties with visualizations, and that's a very complex visualization. But some of us, maybe we have that type of mind, we're more visual, and visualizing really is something that we can connect with. So if that works for you, then use that. Again, the recommendation is use whatever works best for you. But I would expect from most of us, this is probably going to be the object that's going to work best for us, for you rather. So again, pick the object that works best for you and stick with that object. So that's some of the objects that can be very much recommended. Any questions about anything I've covered so far?
Lena assumes that she understands number three mm-hmm. as being like resting in a spaciousness of sort. But then number two is something she would ask you to explain a bit more.
Sure. Okay. So with both two and three, of course, there is very much focus on the mind. And the thing we need to remember, of course, is the mind is not really a thing. You know, often people, when they ask to look at the mind, they go, where is this thing, the mind? Whereas the mind is really that space where things appear. So in the second one, experientially, there is the sense of being the observer, observing the mind. So in the second one,
the mind, which is really this space, and then all the appearances that arise in that space, we have the sense of observing that. We have a sense of being this observer or witness, observing that space, which is the mind, and then all the mental events that arise and pass. So that's what we're focusing on. Whereas the third one, experientially, there's not that sense of a separate observer or witness. It's more like instead of observing the mind, you're just being the mind. So often people find the third one quite difficult because we always want to do something, you know. So the third one is not so much about doing, it's more about being. And many of us find that difficult because what do I got to do? What am I focusing on? Where is it? Because we always want to do something. So the third one is just about being. So, you know, sometimes the analogy given for like the second one, observing the mind, it's like the mind is like the sky, the space, and the thoughts and that are like clouds moving through the sky. So that's the analogy for the second one. So using that analogy, the third one would be to be the sky. Be the sky.
The second one is more about observing it, and the third one is
being it. Yes. Yeah.
Like Lena said, resting in that.
Yeah. Okay. One or two more things before I move on to the Vipassana. In the shamatha practice, we have two main tools. And the two tools we use in this practice is mindfulness and introspection. In Sanskrit is smriti, in Pali sati. And these words literally mean to remember. So mindfulness is basically to remember the object. So mindfulness is our ability to remember or hold the object without becoming distracted. The word mindfulness in a number of, because now mindfulness is sort of the topic in the modern day world. It's the sort of the in thing, you know. Mindfulness is the in thing now. But mindfulness in the modern day world, in a lot of the modern day things that are popping up, is used slightly differently, in a different way. Often mindfulness now in modern traditions is sort of this idea of this non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Of course, this is a good thing to do, but how the word mindfulness was used in the original Buddhist texts was not that. Again, mindfulness is simply to be able to remember the object, to hold the object without becoming distracted. And also one thing that often people, and I think some of the modern systems sort of go a little bit astray, is they say, you know, this non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Of course, non-judgmental means to not react with attachment or aversion. But then often people interpret that non-judgmental is to not evaluate. Meaning, whatever's arising, everything's okay. Let everything be okay. Disaster. Ethical disaster. There's no wisdom there. So what happens, unfortunately, in some modern traditions, is they strip out the ethics. And they say, that's actually wrong. We shouldn't evaluate. Just let everything happen. And this is a big mess. So we need to sort of be aware of that we need to have mindfulness within that framework, particularly the ethical framework. So we need to, in daily life, of course, we need to evaluate situations, which situations are beneficial, which are harmful. So that's just something I thought was important because that's where often people sort of go astray in some of the modern traditions.
But here, in this shamatha practice, mindfulness simply means to remember, to hold the object. But then we need introspection. Introspection is sometimes called vigilance. It's very similar to the idea of, in psychology, of metacognition, the idea of monitoring. So introspection is like quality control. It's monitoring. How is our mindfulness going? Are we becoming dull or distracted? So that's introspection, is quality control. And so introspection's job is to monitor, is to monitor the mindfulness. Are we becoming dull and distracted? If so, fix it, correct it, reapply mindfulness. So these are the two main tools we use in the shamatha practice. And then the job, of course, is to use mindfulness introspection to cultivate the relaxation, the stability, and the clarity. And that if we notice that we're becoming distracted, then with introspection to notice that, then is to reapply the mindfulness. Same thing, if we notice our mind is becoming very dull, then sharpen, reapply the mindfulness, strengthen the mindfulness. So this is what we need to do to progress along this path of shamatha. Of course, there's a lot more to talk about in the shamatha practice, but I think that is enough for now. Just one more point, and then maybe there's a few questions before I move on. And that is, in general, with meditation, the emphasis is quality over quantity, particularly here in shamatha practice. It's much better to meditate for 20 minutes in a clear, good way, rather than 1 hour where you're just simply becoming spaced out and dull and distracted. So with shamatha practice, the emphasis is to keep the sessions short. How short depends on us as an individual, what our capacity is. I think for many of us as a beginner, often the ballpark figure, which is probably about appropriate for many of us to begin, is 20 to 25 minutes. 20 minutes enough to start. More than 25, we're probably going to start slipping into just dullness and distraction. But some of us, maybe that's a little bit long. Some of us maybe can meditate longer in a very good way. One way to tell how long to meditate is our enthusiasm to meditate the same at the end as it was the beginning? If towards the end of the meditation our enthusiasm is dropping off, we're meditating too long. Shorten. And also, it's important here to have a fixed amount of time to meditate in shamatha. Because otherwise, two things are likely to happen. If we don't, so therefore it's good to set like a timer for our meditation. If we don't, what will happen probably is on days where things are not going well, maybe after 5 or 10 minutes you go, oh, this is too difficult today, I'll just stop. Which means, of course, we are not developing perseverance. We need perseverance in the spiritual practice. And then we're just still the slaves of our mind. Our mind is dictating to us what to do. So that's not good. So therefore, if you have a timer, even on days when things are difficult, you'll persevere and complete the meditation. So that will develop perseverance. But also on other days where things are going very well, then if we don't set a timer, then what happens, of course, is we just keep going because things are going well, you know, we just keep going. And then, of course, how long do we keep going? We keep going until it starts to go bad, until we start getting completely distracted or dull, and then we stop. And the thing we remember most about meditation is how it ended. So if we always, and then we start associating meditation with just bad experiences, we're not going to want to meditate again. Whereas if we have a timer and if things are going really well and the timer goes and we stop, that's what we remember. And then we're going to be keen to meditate again the following day. So I think for that reason, those two reasons, it's important to have a fixed amount of time. And then, of course, as we improve our shamatha practice, we will need to extend that time, maybe from 20 to 25 minutes, but only extend it 3 to 5 minutes, not more. And then keep extending as we improve our practice. If you really want to meditate longer in the morning and you can sustain that and you want to do more than 20 minutes, then if you want to do like 45 minutes,
break it into two and do a little 2-minute break in the middle. Much better. So that's a little bit advice about shamatha. That's all I really wanted to cover on that now. Is there any questions on the shamatha practice before we move on to the vipassana practice? Nope. Okay. So that's covering here where it says, once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects. And then the second line in the verse says, and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality. So of course this is talking about the wisdom practice or the vipassana practice. And of course here, the wisdom we're talking about is this wisdom of emptiness. This wisdom realizing that there is no independent objective world, no independent subjective me. And before I go into looking at what does emptiness mean and what the flip side, the idea of dependent arising, the interdependency, what that really means, is what I'd like to do now is have a look at why believing in an independent me and an independent world, why is that the root of all of our suffering? So for that, we're going to use the chart that you've got, which I've got to find mine, the suffering and its causes chart. So if you'd like to get that out, we'll look at that. Are missing must be beyond suffering then. Good.
Now you give us the causes of suffering.
Anyone else?
Everybody?
Everyone's suffering now. Okay. We're all in it together. Don't want to leave anyone out, you know. Okay. So here we have the first step in the process is called is what's called seed of ignorance. So here ignorance is this fundamental ignorance. So this ignorance is this grasping onto and believing in independent me, independent objective world. And seed of ignorance, seed here is the habit. Our habit of grasping onto independent me, independent world. And we've had that habit since we were born and according to Buddhism, way before that. And then we see together with that what's called mistaken dualistic appearance. What that means is that when we look out on the world, everything that appears to us appears to exist independent of us. But this view of reality that we're looking at here, this idea of emptiness, is saying things are not existing in the way they appear. Even though things appear to exist completely independent of us, they do not exist in that way. So dualistic appearance means there appears to be subject-object duality. There appears to be a me here and a world there, independent. That subject-object duality. And this view is saying that this is mistaken. There is no duality. There is no independent me, independent world. But that is how things are appearing to us. Things have always appeared to us in that way. We've never seen the world in any other way. And we have the habit of believing that. And so we never question these appearances. So we automatically accept appearances, which leads us to step two.
which is ignorance. So step two, ignorance means we are simply grasping onto and instinctively believing me here, world there, independent of me. Every time we experience something, we have this mental factor of feeling present. And here in Buddhism, the word, I mean, normally the word feeling, when we use the word feeling in English language, we often mean emotion. But here, feeling, the word feeling in Buddhism doesn't mean emotion. Feeling is a mental factor that whereby we are experiencing things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that's what feeling is in Buddhism, the word feeling. The word feeling is simply the experience of things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So let's take an example here. Let's say we're looking at these flowers. These flowers appear to exist independent of us. They really do. You know, when we walk in this room, there really appears to be some flowers existing there already. We have the habit of believing that, so we just instinctively believe, yes, there's some flowers there existing on their own, independent of me. And let's say when we look at those flowers, we have a pleasant feeling. Then that pleasant feeling, together with this belief that those flowers are independent of us, will lead to the third step. Which is a misconception. Because if I'm having a pleasant feeling and I believe those flowers exist independent of me, then of course we will naturally assume there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. So we're going to see those flowers as inherently attractive. Or if I'm having an unpleasant feeling, together with the belief that those flowers are existing there independent of me, we'll naturally assume there must be some unattractive quality there that's causing my unpleasant feeling. So we'll see them as inherently unattractive. Or if I look at those flowers and I'm having a neutral feeling, and of course neutral just means neither pleasant nor unpleasant, then we'll go on to believe, of course, there must be some inherently neutral qualities there that's causing my neutral experience. So we'll see them as inherently neutral. So once we've got to step three, then step four easily follows. Because again, let's say, for instance, we're looking at these flowers, we're having a pleasant experience, we're therefore believing that there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. Then of course, I like pleasant feelings, I want pleasant feelings, those flowers seem to be causing my pleasant feelings, I want those flowers. Attachment. Or if I'm having an unpleasant feeling, I don't want unpleasant feelings, those flowers seem to be causing my unpleasant feelings, get them out of here. Aversion. Or if I'm having a neutral feeling, then all that will really do is reinforce my belief that these flowers are existing independent of me, which is ignorance. And normally here, they use the word confusion instead of ignorance. Here, confusion, of course, doesn't mean are these flowers or not. This confusion is just confusion about how they exist. So here confusion is just another different word for ignorance. So we're just reinforcing our ignorant belief that these flowers are existing independent of us. These mental states of particularly attachment and aversion, if we really look at them closely, they also lead to our other mental afflictions. So other mental afflictions such as jealousy and craving and all these other mental afflictions will come out of one of those or a combination of them. And then these mental afflictions are what's driving our behavior. And of course, as we saw earlier in the topic of karma, every action we do with a motivation has a result. And the results of our actions are our experiences. And our experiences collectively are called dukkha. So this is how our current state of dukkha is actually coming from this fundamental ignorance. This fundamental ignorance, grasping onto independent me, independent world, is the source of dukkha. So if we want to overcome dukkha, if we want to overcome suffering, then we need to go back to the source. We need to get rid of this ignorance. So to get rid of this ignorance, of course, we need to develop wisdom. We need to develop the wisdom that there is no independent me, no independent objective world. We need to develop and cultivate this wisdom of emptiness. Any questions on that? Okay. As you see in your diagram, there's one little bit more that I haven't added yet, so I'll add that now. Every time we have ignorance, we're grasping onto this me and this independent world. That, of course, will reinforce our habit of believing that and grasping. But also this ignorance has a side effect. And that is called, normally the technical word is latency of ignorance. Another word for latency is stain, which means that this ignorance in our mind stains our mind. And that stain of ignorance, what that does is that when we come into contact with an object, that object appears in this mistaken dualistic way. So we are looking out on the world through these stains of ignorance. And to sort of understand what we mean by the word stain here, often in the meditation, in the text, they give the analogy. They say, imagine you have a bowl, you have a clove of garlic, you put the garlic in the bowl, which is like the seed of ignorance, that clove of garlic will stain the bowl with a smell. So even if you take the clove out, there's still the stain, the smell of the garlic left behind. So that's often the analogy given to understand sort of what we mean by this stain of ignorance. And that stain, again, means that objects appear when we, as in a mistaken dualistic way to us. And so what we can understand here is that if we want to overcome dukkha, if we want to get out of the cycle of samsara, we need to go back to the source. So if we want to achieve nirvana, we need to get rid of this. We need to develop the wisdom of emptiness. We need to realize emptiness, which will get rid of this, which will get rid of our mental afflictions, our karma, our actions, and thereby we'll overcome dukkha and achieve nirvana. So this ignorance and the mental afflictions is often, and we see that at the bottom of that chart, this is what's called the afflictive obscurations. Afflictive obscurations are the ignorance, the mental afflictions that obstruct us from achieving nirvana. So we have to get rid of this if we want to achieve nirvana. So that's what's called the afflictive obscurations. So if we do that, we can achieve nirvana, we can become an arhat. But here in the Mahayana path, we want to achieve the goal of enlightenment. So what's left over is this. So if we want to move from nirvana to enlightenment, we need to get rid of these stains and this mistaken dualistic appearance. So this is what's called the cognitive obscurations. We see that at the bottom there, they are mentioned. So the cognitive obscurations are these subtle stains or latencies of ignorance and all the mistaken dualistic appearance that comes from that. So if we want to achieve enlightenment, we have to get rid of this, which is more difficult to get rid of than this. But that's the difference between nirvana and enlightenment. We need to get rid of these stains. Which means, actually, someone who's achieved nirvana, who's become an arhat, when they look out on the world appears to them in the same way as it appears to us. There appears to exist an independent world. But because they've already directly realized emptiness, they know that these appearances are mistaken. So they never accept them. So they never cause a problem. But they're still there. To get rid of that mistaken appearance, they need to get rid of these stains. And when we become enlightened, then we have eliminated those stains, and then things appear to us in the correct way. Of course, what that really means, we cannot really fathom, because we've never had that experience. But that's what an enlightened person experiences. Any questions on then the what I've covered?
Is this discussion listed anywhere? Because it sounds very much like the 12 links of dependent origination.
Correct.
But not exactly.
Correct. That's right. I mean, effectively, this is the first two of the Four Noble Truths. Remember, the first noble truth is dukkha. The second noble truth, the cause or origin of dukkha, was the two things, the mental afflictions and karma. So here's the karma, and here's the mental afflictions. So all I've done here is I've unpacked the mental afflictions, how we get from ignorance to the other mental afflictions. And this process here is coming from, we see at the top of this chart, this quote from Nagarjuna. So remember, Nagarjuna was the founder of this Majjhimika philosophical system. So he, and this is in the second century, he was saying, by extinguishing actions and mental afflictions, there is liberation. So by eliminating ignorance, mental afflictions and actions, we become liberated. Actions and mental afflictions arise from misconceptions here. Misconceptions, they arise from elaborations. Elaborations here is another word for ignorance. Elaboration, in English, to elaborate something means to make more of it. So ignorance, of course, is we are adding to what's there. We are superimposing that on top of reality that it exists independently. We are projecting that. So that's what the word elaboration means. It means we are adding something that's not there. So ignorance is adding or believing that this is existing independently. So here, then, when Nagarjuna says they arise from elaborations, it means they arise from ignorance. And therefore, elaborations will cease through cultivating emptiness. Ignorance will cease through cultivating emptiness. So this is
a little bit unpacked the mental afflictions, again based on this Nagarjuna's verse, and you're right, is that the 12 links is, so this is the general process. The 12 links is talking about a specific aspect of this. The 12 links is only talking about this process in terms of the connection from one life to the next, the rebirth process. So, of course, this is happening all the time. But within that process, there are certain actions which will lead to a new life. And so the 12 links are describing how that whole process works. So the 12 links is a very specific aspect of this general process, in the process of how we continually are reborn through this process. So that's the way. Sure.
At number two,
yeah.
Ignorance and feeling.
Yeah.
Is feeling part of the afflictive aspirations or just ignorance?
Just ignorance.
What is feeling?
How can you have what? Well, feeling is what's called an omnipresent mental factor, so it's always there, but it's not our pleasant and unpleasant feelings that get us into trouble. It's this that gets us into trouble. So that's the culprit. Yeah.
Okay, then we've finished for the day. We've run out of time. So what I'm planning to do then tomorrow evening, of course, is based on what we've looked here, I want then tomorrow evening in the first session is unpack this wisdom of emptiness. What do we mean by emptiness? And the flip side of that, of course, is dependent arising. What we mean by things being interdependent. And then I'd like to also look at how we then practice this wisdom of emptiness on the different stages of the Mahayana path. So we'll be looking at this chart as well a little bit. And then we're going to finish off with the rest of the verses on the second page, where the first three verses are talking about the Tantra or Vajrayana level of the practice. So we'll be briefly looking at that, and then there's a couple of sort of dedication verses at the end of the text, which we'll finish off tomorrow evening. So that's the program for tomorrow evening. So let's leave it there. So have a nice evening, and see you tomorrow evening.